This is April 6, 2017, correct?
Yes.
Module 18, we're discussing the Heart Sutra. This is class 3 of that module, and the subject is, Thus Have I Heard, the Five Excellences. And I find this particular subject... Anyway, congratulations.
Yes, that's what we forgot to announce.
I've been announcing it so much I didn't feel that was
a good thing.
I meant to announce it.
Yes, yeah, no, congratulations.
Congratulations. Retirement.
Yay.
So, it's a fantastic subject because it's so multifaceted, those four words. And I thought to begin, which we do with the Heart Sutra, and in fact is the opening to essentially all the sutras in my reading, but we'll get to that. But I just wanted to take a minute in the context of this for us to appreciate the fact that we actually have heard the Dharma. We wanted to hear the Dharma. We study Dharma. And the Dharma is accessible to us. So easy to take for granted. And why I bring it up is because what I'm hoping to point out is that every moment of our lives that have led us to this point of hearing the Dharma, wanting to hear the Dharma, had to occur, as it did, to be on this path at all. And I think it's quite easy to forget because we're flooded by Dharma language, or in our wider communities now, which it wasn't so 30 or 40 years ago, and we can assume it can be easy to mistake that for actually hearing the Dharma. And our purpose here as teachers is really because of this, is to be able to teach without, because we are also on the path of working with our own, this life to wake up. So we are all on this remarkable path together, and that we were all brought together, the karma that brought all of us together in this circumstance is remarkable. So not to belabor that, but I really wanted to point that out. That the causes and conditions that enable us to come is, again, remarkable. May not be so for another generation. Who knows what comes down the line? That you, in your life, have run into your root teacher. How remarkable is that? So it's something I wish for all of us, according to our own paths and desires. But at any rate, that is indeed not separate from Thus Have I Heard. In fact. So, Thus Have I Heard is the beginning of these sutras, and it's always followed by the name of the teacher and the place where this teaching took place. And it's not quite Once Upon a Time, but it could be, if you're not listening, it could be very well ignored. Okay, Once Upon a Time, I heard this story. But this isn't it, actually. It's much more dimensional than that. When I was preparing this class, someone told me about Dzongsar Kensei saying, I have something here that he said, but he also used the phrase that it is, of course it's out of my mind right now, so I'll read this right now.
Okay.
But basically, by default, it's kind of like the teacher's default, but it isn't. Just sort of, you could just say, well, thus have I heard, and so, such and such said, blah, blah, blah. But really, what you're saying could be read in a number of different ways. He said, if you read the classic Buddhist texts like the sutras, it all begins with, thus have I heard. Once Buddha was here, there, you know, like that, thus have I heard. It's a very important statement because Ananda is saying, I don't know what he talked about, but that's what I heard. So, the fact is that no one was writing these words down. It was all an oral history. Did it happen? Did so-and-so say this and that? That's what I heard. But at the same time, there is this very strong thread that goes from, and it's a very important part of the Buddhist lineage, that I heard the Dharma from my teacher, who heard it from her teacher, who heard it from his teacher, back. So there's some sense of continuity and a sense of trustworthiness, that you're not being given a made-up thing. Or are you? And I'm not trying to sow discord or doubt, but what I'm trying to say is, wake up. This is your instant of connection to what resonates with you as... It's a live transmission from teacher to student. And I'm not saying that we're... that we is that. But that
don't just point to the lineage. That doesn't answer.
You can't just point to the lineage, because otherwise as how lovely that thing you posted with Kandarimshe. Otherwise you're just parroting.
Right.
Xerox, and you're just a Xerox copy, she says.
I love that.
It was perfect. Because this isn't about you remembering what somebody said and then spouting what somebody said. And that enabling you to be an authority. It's just like something you... Therefore, it's just like something you read on the internet. And so what? Oh, this is a fact I know. No, the reason why it's different is, which we'll get into, is because of the five excellencies. And actually, I don't have my... Yeah, I do. There were some places they called them the six excellencies, which one is faith, but that's somewhat different. But what I wanted to just... put an emphasis on is that we say thus, which is okay, this is it, this is the teaching that I heard. Have I heard somebody say, or I heard it directly? So there's a real kind of authenticity. It isn't like you can go to the store and buy that. It's actually this is your experience. Trustworthy again. So, therefore, we're going to talk about hearing the Dharma. And in this book, Bernholtzl talks about what is required to be able to actually be in a position where you actually hear the Dharma. And you actually hear the Dharma. You actually hear what's being transmitted. He said the first thing is the excellent time. You happen to be in the right place at the right time for you to hear that. But we should ask ourselves, did Emily hear what I heard? Is there any way to know that Harry Bob's experience, that he walks away with, utterly convinced this was the nature, that this woke him up, was what was actually said? Well, there is no way, rhetorically, she asks, and answers. And that's the remarkable truth about our Dharma paths, is that in some way, no matter what we're hearing, how we hear is interpreted through our own experience. And that it's remarkable that we can have a conversation together, and each one of us perhaps goes away with some kind of understanding that continues to help us on our path.
Can I say something about the time?
Of course.
So that I was thinking about this today, the excellent time, and I was thinking that it was 3 years ago that we actually started teaching, and we didn't start with the Heart Sutra. It's 3 years later that we're doing the Heart Sutra, and it was introduced last fall, so you can see the ground was laid, and then I think Michael Fagan said, why don't we all chant that? I thought, okay, I guess we could probably try that now. Where there's already the ground was laid and people had other teachings that they had heard. So this particular teaching, we wouldn't really kind of open the door and let people, you know, people jump into it right away. But there is some ground that was laid. So and at the same time, anybody can hear it at any point. So that's not a problem either. But I think it's very interesting. There's a sense of ripening and the right time for something to happen.
Exactly.
And I think that was the Buddha's situation. This wasn't the first teaching he gave. He had a Dharma, he had a Sangha, and they were ready to hear this particular teaching.
Yeah. I think also that accounts for all of us, that we in our lives have to achieve a point of ripening before we can actually hear the Dharma.
Right. And what's fascinating about that, actually, is that you're endlessly ripening.
Yes.
Yeah.
That, and we've talked about this before, that we've been saying the Heart Sutra for 40 years, more than 40 years, right?
Yeah.
Speaking for myself, I now understand it in a way that I wouldn't have understood 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And certainly when I first heard it, I thought, oh, yeah, blah, 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 blah. You know? You know, okay, no eye, no ear, no nose, no. Okay, I can kind of... But, and it continues that way, so the time itself is a very interesting factor. Mm-hmm. But yes, exactly so. He discusses what we're actually saying with the word evam, which is thus. So the is this the Sanskrit or the evam?
That's Sanskrit.
The Sanskrit, yeah. Evam, which, and I wonder how any of these, we're going to meander through the five excellencies, so forgive me. But if any of you were curious about the language that he used to describe these, this word evam, as in A and vam are parents of all the letters of the sutra. Did anybody pick up on that? And that A also, their root syllables of all the teachings of the Buddha. What does do we mean by that?
Again, I read it. I didn't.
Right, right. It's kind
okay.
of. I'm not asking you to.
No. It just was like.
Right. Right. So just cook. Let it cook.
We said they're like the peers.
So there, A is also prajna, which we talked about prajna, paramita,
and
wisdom. And vam is wisdom, and vam is skillful means. So again, these are the tools of compassion. And A again is considered emptiness, and vam, compassion. So the two major principles from the Mahayana point of view, these summarize all the teachings of the Dharma. So I think part of what we have to understand when we work with a practice like this is that we're not going to understand this in a linear, literal way, but in fact it penetrates over time and in different the more you practice and the more you yourself study, the more these things resonate with you. And so there's the point of this whole practice is not to tighten you up as a good Buddhist, but actually to sort of start prying you loose from any conceptual view of what this is, of what who you are, and this world that you're inhabiting. So in a way, you've already taken a leap that you may not know you took, or that you even wanted to take, but you're already in. So, if you have any questions, or if I'm...
The two syllables are said to represent, is that sort of, as people have studied over the years and the centuries, that people have analyzed and said that, like, are said to represent doesn't credit where it comes from.
I think that, well, I don't know, but I would have to say that he makes so many references in this book that I'm not familiar with, and that you can take any line from any sutra and study it in a million different ways, and there'll be 10,000 commentaries on that one syllable or that one word. And so, sure.
But also the parent here can be explained more by A is the feminine, wisdom, prajna,
yeah, we talked about that.
And vam is skillful means. As Erica said, that's considered the masculine. So those are the parents that give birth to the... Sorry?
There's a pretty strong tradition in Sanskrit of the idea that Sanskrit is in some sense the perfect grammar, and that there's actually a certain, you know, that it was not a spoken language, it was a somewhat constructed language, and that grammar is considered almost a fine art in the classical cultures. And so the notion of these, you know, without knowing that deeply, you know, myself, I know that the idea of the certain syllables having qualities and the derivations,
yeah.
that's a strong tradition just associated with the Sanskrit language even before the Buddhist, you know, Buddhist scriptures were put into those, that language.
This is right up your alley, actually.
That's great. Yeah.
And yet the Buddhists flipped it around. They turned it up, but the Buddhists turned it upside down. They made wisdom feminine and skillful means masculine, and that they flipped it from the Hindu.
I just have a question, and I think I'm trying to pin it down too much. So A is feminine, means emptiness, and prajna, wisdom, and vam is masculine, means skillful means, and also compassion. So that's...
According to this text,
yes, okay.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
Frankly, from my point of view, I'm just... I'm allowing this to sort of gestate in me or cook in me. because I still I don't know why. So I'm coming to know this myself, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Is it reasonable to think of it more like, not exactly literally means, but like poetic associations? Is that another way to read
right.
Not like A and Vaughn, it's not just the dictionary.
Right.
Connotations. Yeah.
But I think the whole point is that that for us to try to pin it down and solidify any of it, this is all information that is really important to add to your understanding and add to your practice. And as things have a kind of resonate with you, as your experience changes and grows, things make sense to you. It's like doing the Lojong, the slogans, that as you live your life, a slogan will pop up, and it's because you're in such and such a situation that it all of a sudden resonates with you or will come up and make sense for you. So the second excellency is you're at the right place, at the right time. You're at the right time with the right teacher. And this is, of course, not an ordinary teacher. It's a fully awakened teacher whom you cannot solidify or pin down or think you're going to or you think he's going to make everything crystal clear for you. In fact, what's more likely is that the teacher we'll talk about this later in the outline, but the teacher himself, the presence of the teacher himself, is the most powerful teaching, in a sense, that it's because of the presence of this teacher that the teaching can take place. The emanation of the teacher's energy.
Because it's actually he doesn't speak to Leanne when he says, good job.
Yeah.
But he's not speaking.
He's not speaking.
Right, in language. In language. But as Emily said, Emily or Michael, I think, said that the sun is fundamentally always shining. And it's obscure. The teacher is always radiating, but it's the obscuration of it's our own obscurations that make it difficult for us to see the clouds of our own obscuration create the issue. So, the teacher's the presence is what is radiating, and of course, there's the excellent place. The location where the teacher's taking place, and Vulture Peak Mountain, where Emily has been, is this location. And I've often thought how interesting, you know how when you want to go to you think about going to a party, and you're afraid, you can't go, and you're afraid you're going to miss something.
You know all the Madonnas are going to be there.
All the lovely. and there's this real sense that your life has brought you to a place where you are able to hear this teaching from this teacher in this place. And that, from the Buddhist perspective, is according to your merit, which is a whole other subject. And your capacity to hear the Dharma. The fourth excellency is the excellent retinue, which you could say here are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and lay practitioners, but also us, the Sangha, that we are inhabiting. That we're part of creating the container that enables each one of us to hear the Dharma. And then, of course, the fifth is the excellent teaching. And here it's very straightforward. It's on the samadhi of enumerating phenomena. The nature of phenomena. So the teacher isn't just going to teach you about the... So I'm going to teach you about a thing. In a sense, the teacher's enlightened mind enables you to experience, in the Prajnaparamita, the experience of emptiness directly. So that's what the presence of this teacher has the capacity to do, or the Buddha has the capacity to do.
Do you think that's because they're just sort of shining their Buddha nature? So like there's no, you know, the energy coming out from a teacher is just very pure.
I think that, well, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because it's your mind is receptive to the mind of the teacher. So it's almost, there's a sort of, could you call it falling in love? Could you say there's that state of where nothing, where you're almost obliterated with by the nature of the energy itself? Of this, that this teaching requires the presence of the open mind of the teaching requires the open mind of the of the student.
But as you can like. And then I lost the guy's name we went to see last month.
I'm sorry?
What? Who was the teacher we went to see last month?
Oh, Kinglong Rinpoche.
But just like sitting there, it like we came receptive, we wanted to hear, but there was something about his presence that just opened your mind to like to actually hear it. You know, and it's the difference between, the, like you said, that, you know, I hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you're like, oh, wait, that's about the life that I'm in right now. It's not just a story.
Theoretical, right.
It's not theoretical. It's about me right here, right now. I mean, I just, coming through here, I found, you know, something I'd written down that he'd said that I'm looking, I said, where's that idea from? Like, oh, from the teacher.
Well, you know, this is really interesting that you would say that, because that just proves my point in a way. You may have written it down, and you're writing things down, but then with your own ripening, you run across it, and it's no longer just something that you wrote down. It's actually waking you up. It actually...
Thus have I heard.
Thus have I heard. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And to reiterate his, non-conceptual, non-dual wisdom that realizes profound emptiness and illuminates the darkness of ignorance. What does that mean? Does that make any sense to anybody?
Anyone in this room?
That would be good. I could say that the presence of the teacher transmits directly non-dual emptiness, meaning you're not sitting there going, he's flashing emptiness to me, or she's transmitting that, and it illuminates the darkness of ignorance, which is fundamentally chronic. Like that, your opportunity to wake up, it creates the light by which you can see clearly, even for a second.
I think the non-dual is also a key phrase here. And it points to something which is often overlooked in the way that we think about teachers
in ourselves, which is that we tend to set that up as
that's right.
a self and other right there. And maybe all the teacher is actually doing is just clearing the fog from our own understanding, not transmitting something which you don't already have.
Correct.
So it's shining the light, which also you already have,
yeah.
but making it clear, I know this, mm-hmm. I understand mm-hmm. this. And there is, in fact, no separation between me and the teacher.
Right, and the word transmission sort of emphasizes almost that implies duality.
Yes. I'm glad you said that.
Subject and object.
Yeah. I'm glad both of you brought this up, because I'm, as we're talking, I'm here imagining where it's like we're like here's the teacher going right. That isn't the what you're saying is what the presence of the teacher. The teacher isn't doing anything, which is what we're doing.
There's something about the teacher, though, that I think allows a person to see, like when you're talking about, just seeing that teacher in the church. There's something evident about a really fully realized teacher, I think, that there's a clarity. But it's not the clarity of an other. It's just it somehow reveals the clarity. The actual clarity is already present here, always already present.
Right.
And it's just all right. That's the phrase in the Bible is the scales fell from my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Paul that said that. The scales fell from my eyes, and I could actually see. But when I'm actually seeing. What's already here. But what's already here is also everywhere. Because there is no fundamental difference between here and there.
So
me and other.
But the issue of duality that is here and that you bring up, that we're really happy to, we really get that we fundamentally are temporary and are terminal and we can see that we don't exist as any solid, continuous thing. We've worked with analytical meditation in this group, but fundamentally we know that. But there's still this, so that the emptiness of ourselves, but we still sort of tend to solidify what is out there, one of which is the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And But the teacher doesn't care about that. It's like, he's not interested in that. And that's what ends up being transmitted is that just hanging out in this open space. And it's so much easier in that context to see where we slap a conclusion on the experience or on the teacher but really the event itself is indescribable, ineffable, and has no substance, there's no substance. But the basis of, the whole reason the teacher's there is because of his or her compassionate willingness to continue to teach the Dharma. That's the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva.
Do you notice also that luminosity is a word used here a lot? In other words, light is part of the imagery that's being talked about, and even sometimes specific colored light. But light is an image to push us past duality or past nothingness.
I'm just thinking the times when I've heard Dharma where suddenly, And it's almost more that what they're illuminating is like most of what you're thinking is blah, 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 blah. And me, and this about me, and that about that person. And then suddenly someone shows you, like, no, that's not, like the light is, that's not it. Look, you know, just notice. You already know this thing. But you spend so much time with the other stuff that's not
that's really.
So you've done the sadhana of Mahamudra.
Right.
Right. Is it, although I dwell in the
slime and muck of the dark ages, I still aspire to see your face.
Or the fog of material. Yeah, the fog of materialism. I can't remember that. That's right. So we end up in a fog of our, and this light, this luminosity, burns that fog away. That's right.
Well, it just shows us, like, that's not where you need to look. Look, that's, it's just slime.
So on page 76, there's this wonderful, about this mind-to-mind transmission. He says, the Buddha kindles the energy of his own Buddha nature to radiate out to the audience, which triggers a reaction in the Buddha nature of everyone present. He says, for example, it's like plucking a bowstring. Plucking a...
That's an in-joke.
Yeah, sorry. I had to do that. Plucking a string that resonates with the other strings. That resonates the other strings, even though you haven't touched the other strings. So, this is... I thought this was a particularly wonderful way to express that, that it triggers a reaction in your own Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. Where is
and you recognize
right
your own
here
Buddha nature.
76.
It's 76. Yeah. Yeah.
Same Buddha nature. So the, I think the metaphor strings breaks down a little bit of us.
Okay.
You know, it's a problem with language.
That's why he says
language.
It's a crude example.
Yeah. I mean, language is dualistic by nature, so it's never possible to really describe what's going on. But I think there is no two Buddha natures or seven Buddha natures. There's
you won't get an argument.
Okay.
For me.
I know that the retreat that we went to over New Year's, that I came back with one sentence from the teacher: all non-dual present mind is the same. And I've been holding on to that sentence and working away at that sentence for a while.
That's That's good. So, it does seem that the reason why we need a teacher, we generally don't recognize that unless somebody points it out to us, points out the nature of our own mind, or our mind.
Is that why there's such affection? I've found when you hear Dharma that resonates with you, and it just feels like you are touching, I hate to say the truth because it's an overused word, but it's the Buddha nature. And then after that, there's a huge amount of affection for that moment that happens.
That makes sense to me. That's been my experience. that there's such a profound relief.
Yes, to know relief is a great word for it.
I don't have to carry this me
right
with everywhere
right
armed to the teeth somehow, or you know, protecting myself, or and it's such a how remarkable to be you're so grateful somebody would point that out to you.
It's like a big burden taken off, or wiping away of the mirror is your analogy, even if it's just a moment.
The essence of Buddha nature is surely the same, but the transmission of an experience is a particular touching, contact, illuminating, whatever it is. And is not the same as any other that's ever occurred at any other time.
It can happen more than once, though. What do you mean, any other? What does that mean?
That this particular moment
right
is not something that could be repeated.
Yeah.
The moment is the moment.
That's right.
And the color of it, or the touching of it, or the light of it, or whatever is this moment.
It's a mistake to try to reclaim it, to try to get back.
You can't.
Right.
Nor can you. I mean, it's so interesting. This party where all those damn Adonis are hanging out, that or this teaching, let's just say this teaching. Like people will always come back from a teaching and you say, how wasn't it? It's the most incredible experience. It's an incredible teaching I ever had. And you're like, wow, I've missed that. You know? And so there's a kind of sense of, you have to be really careful not to be materialistic or grasping or greedy about our experience, that our lives have led us to this moment where one encountered the teacher, and to somebody else, perhaps to a different moment, where they encountered the teacher, as to each of our needs and preparedness for that at that point and at that moment. And actually that too has a kind of relief of the sense of it isn't like you missed the only thing. It's the only thing open, you know, that the real work is in a way cutting down our sense that we need to get everything.
But it's also that most of the time when something hits me, I go, oh, wow, that's so... And then like an hour later, I'll go, I've heard that 50 times before, mm-hmm. and the causes and conditions weren't right.
Exactly.
And it didn't... I didn't get it. I heard it. I sat in the room and somebody said it to me, or I read it in a book, or I listened to it. Hey, but when the conditions are right, you'll hear it. And even if you went to the talk that your friend said was so amazing, you might have said, that's the same old Dharma.
Well, that's exactly right.
Same old, same old.
That's exactly right. I've heard that a million times before.
And then someday someone says it to you, like, oh my God, why didn't anybody ever tell me?
And if somebody comes up with a brand new Dharma, that might have its own consequences. Well, that's why I'm listening to those lectures. I'm on my fourth time through those lectures. And I'm not bored.
No.
Because every time I hear them, I'm getting something a little bit different.
Right.
Khandra Rinpoche's lectures, yes.
Yeah. Well, because you're not the same person going in.
Right.
Right.
That's it.
Progress along the path. It's a kind of interesting phrase. Progress along the path. progress along the path.
I'm thinking that actually an analogy is that you can listen to a symphony more than once. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah. How many times do you listen to a Beatles song?
Yeah.
Why not a teaching?
You can listen to a symphony more than once even though you know how it ends.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly didn't mean to say earlier or to imply at all that there is not something very special that happens between a teacher and a bright student. There certainly is. I was sort of pondering what it is that actually happens there. Just sort of exploring. And I do think that Buddha nature is undivided, infinite, and eternal. And it's not like a teacher's Buddha nature being transmitted to me,
right.
But maybe it's just peeling away the layers of my own onion so that I can see that same Buddha nature. And maybe that's what's being transmitted. It's just I look at this teacher and I listen and I see that that teacher is undivided, unseparate, unseparated. And I look at that and wonder, and I say, and then just the presence of that shows me that is possible.
Is that an experience you've had with specific teachers? Or just curious.
At times, yeah.
And Carl says several times in his book that the text and all the commentary is not teaching emptiness, which is not possible to teach. It's teaching on the layers of experience we can work through. And more and more, and the further we go, the more of them, the more subtle ones we can hear.
Mm.
And also there is a sense that the teacher that actually enables you to, that connects with you, or that you connect with, or that enables, it's a vehicle by which you wake yourself up.
Yeah.
Maybe not the one that's why there are 84,000 dharmas, is that what they are? So somebody, a teacher, I remember it was this, we used to call him Long Tongue Tulku. He came and he spoke at the old Dharmadhatu years and years and years ago, and he went on and on and on and on, and we're all like this, oh my God. And there was, not all of us, some people made a profound connection with what this person said and how he talked, how he spoke. Others of us could not. It wasn't a meeting. And that's actually fine. Whatever it takes to wake us up. Hopefully we have developed the causes and conditions to encounter that. I just have a couple of more things in this. Oh, and vis-a-vis two wisdoms. This wisdom of variety is kind of, in a way, what we're tangentially talking about, knowing all phenomena in their distinct ways of appearing and interacting. So I do think there is a sense that a teacher can see, because a teacher is seeing one from a perspective of it's not an ego centered perspective. They see our suffering, and they can see what may be the best means by which to transmit what we, the student, need to hear. I don't think there's any problem in looking at it that way.
It's discriminating awareness, wisdom.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, and then he talks about the basis of the Buddha's activity is his compassion, for her compassion. And there's three types of compassion. Ordinary compassion is kind of what we're talking about.
Can be fishy.
I'm sorry?
Oh, it can be fishy.
Right. Well, okay, we'll say there's ordinary compassion. There's so-and-so broke their leg and it really make you sad, or, you know, a dog is being mistreated or something, and you have compassion for that animal or a person. Right. You have compassion. You really see that and you want to be of help. It's completely valid, completely lovely. But there could be, but the misunderstanding here is that there is an I and other, and that there's this me that's perceiving something that's suffering, there's that's suffering, and then I'm going to be all compassionate about it. And it's a really dangerous, it's as important as it is, it can be a real ego builder, that I'm just going to help that, I'm just going to... I'm being compassionate to this person. It can really have it's incomplete and inaccurate. Because from the absolute point of view, there is no I, other, and no action being taken place at all, which is the no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, which is... which is something that I think we ought to talk about, because I think, and now probably isn't the time, but it's, do we really believe that? And how do we wrap our minds around it? Really, the Heart Sutra, what we're saying in the Heart Sutra. So the second
teaser.
One is, I'm sorry?
That's the teaser for the future.
Right.
Contemplate that. It'll come up.
Yeah, that's it.
That will get us back.
In a world where no I, no we.
Right. So we're all talking about this delusion that I exist, and that we're suffering because we really think we exist. And we do suffer because we think we exist. And from the Bodhisattva point of view, which I thought was fascinating about this. Did people read this? This is how do bodhisattvas function when you make a commitment to not get off the wheel until everybody's been enlightened and nobody's suffering anymore. How the hell do you do that? What are you talking about? It's like, oh my God, that's just Buddhist mumbo jumbo. Well, in here he explains it in a way that I thought would be really that was really interesting. Which he says the only reason why is because of non-referential compassion, which he says sentient beings not only lack a substantial permanent self, all phenomena is empty, and therefore all-encompassing, non-solidifying compassion arises for all beings. So I think that's really interesting, and that's how bodhisattvas can commit to the liberation of all beings.
You have to work on
that. Yeah. You have to, what did you say?
That's a tough one.
I'm still training.
Yeah.
She has to work on that.
Right. But I thought that was kind of fascinating. I'd never heard that actually addressed so directly. Anybody?
Well, it makes sense because it's the only way you could ever possibly take the bodhisattva vow. I mean, it sounds so crazy. You're gonna liberate all sentient beings. So you're gonna take on the suffering and
the liberation. We do take the vow. We take the vow and we go.
Yeah, but
tomorrow.
I'll figure that out.
Eventually. You have to see through the solidification of the whole thing. Right. That's the whole point. That there's no separation.
Taking the vow?
Right.
Right.
So I think this section, page 79, where this is the third point on the third point of compassion that you read. I think this is really important because. Fundamentally, what he's saying, they are just illusory appearances. In other words, this is the compassion that is based on the realization of the emptiness of all phenomena. So we focus on sentient beings as those who are characterized by the lack of real existence. They are just illusory appearances. So it's not like you're dismissing everything. So that's, this is in a way like a mini summary of what the Heart Sutra is about.
That's right.
You know, because it's not like we're just dismissing everything, but we're actually understanding the truth of emptiness. And one little clue here is illusory appearances. So again, all these things require more contemplation, but I think, you know, we just keep having to come at it from a lot of different angles. But I think this is a really important section that you brought
up.
Yeah,
and you notice I've undermined like almost everything. Yeah. And in fact, this was my intention was
what
to
did you say there?
What do you think?
What do you think
exactly about that?
Right.
About that. So we suffer
because
we have a misperception.
That's important.
A constant misperception.
I think it's also worth noting, and some of us have taken such a vow, that when we take the vow as aspiring, we can't say we're accomplished bodhisattvas, but we take an aspiring vow, and the whole atmosphere of that is not just what the hell have I gotten into, but we do it in front of friends and witnesses, and we do it as a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost always directly followed by something like a party.
So, have any of you not got a book? You need a book, don't you? Let's get you a book. Okay, I will see if I can. You need a book.
If you can help me get one.
You need a book too? Okay.
Well, how are you going to get them?
Well, I'll talk to Michael.
No, he doesn't have any. You have to go online. Just get one from Amazon.
Amazon, yeah.
Just go get one. Michael doesn't have any other copies. He didn't buy tons of
copies. Oh, he didn't? Okay.
No.
You need the support of this material.
Yeah.
It's pretty juicy. And your questions are going to come up that we could benefit from your contribution. Can you do that? Can you get it on Amazon? Okay. I can give you the information.
It's online.
Yeah, I think there's not. I didn't find like 5 other books of the same.
You did. Are they sending it to people's houses by drone overnight?
Yeah, if you're a same Kindle day user delivery that you bring to class, you can get it that way. I don't know if you like.
No, I'm not. But I'll order it.
Yeah,
I think you might. It's one of these books that you'll read, and then you'll go back and you'll open up certain sections, or certain sections will resonate with you, and you'll go, okay, and that's good.
Good, noble family.
Good, noble family.
So it's 9:01.
Okay.